On Earth, mother is insane and your children greatly disturbed, hating one another bitterly. Amidst all those unbalanced minds, a fortune in banknotes. What is the use of all that money, if it doesn't buy one moment's happiness? But I left my family ample means, retorted the unhappy old man. I was anxious for their welfare. Thaline continued, interrupting him, in the question of transitory riches, we don't always know what is the best thing to do. If you had assured your family's future by maintaining an atmosphere of moral tranquility in your home, and prepared your children to earn an honest living, your efforts might have been a great help. Sometimes, father, we accumulate money through pride and ambition. We are anxious to live above others. And while centering our attention on the external aspects of life, we forget the more important, lasting side. Few are those who seek to acquire worthwhile knowledge, and the precious qualities of tolerance, humility and understanding. Instead, we insist on bending others to our will, neglecting the tasks assigned to us by our Father and altogether forgetting to cultivate our spirits. No one is born on the planet merely to hoard money in safes and banks. Of course, during our sojourn we may, as faithful stewards who know how to manage wisely what is entrusted to them, claim our legitimate share. But it is impossible to be our Father's faithful stewards if we are greedy and overbearing. It was that false understanding of divine stewardship that ruined our home. I tried in vain to render spiritual help to the family, while you and mother sacrificed yourselves to increase your worldly goods. Amalia and Casilda, disdaining any useful work, trifled away precious time, finally marrying idlers like themselves. We only married them for their money. Agenor, influenced by his worthless companions, wasted all opportunities of serious study. Edelbert graduated as physician, but was indifferent to the profession. He approached its noble activities only rarely, and even then only out of sheer curiosity. Spoiled by easily obtained money, and with minds fixed on the coming inheritance, they all ruined their fine spiritual possibilities. The patient, terror-stricken, cried out, "Cursed Edelbert! Criminal and ungrateful son! He murdered me pitilessly when I still needed to review the terms of my will. Malicious felon! Please, father, don't say that. Have mercy on your son. Forgive and forget." But he went on cursing and swearing. Thaline was about to resume when Narcissa gave her a warning glance and called Celestius to help the patient, by this time aroused to a dangerous condition of emotional excitement. Thaline became silent, trying hard to keep back her tears. She continued by the bedside, stroking her father's forehead with a gentle hand. Painfully impressed by the scene I had just witnessed, I followed Narcissa and Pauline out of the ward. The two friends talked for some time, and then Pauline took her leave with kind words of thanks. Her eyes showed sadness and worry. When we were again alone, Narcissa remarked, "As a rule, inheritance cases are extremely delicate. With few exceptions, they cause great trouble for both testators and legatees. This case, however, is far more serious because of the euthanasia. Ambition for wealth created all kinds of complexes and misunderstandings in Pauline's family. Avaricious parents generally have extravagant children. I had accompanied her to her earthly home when her brother Edelbert, a gentlemanly doctor, used so-called easy death on his dying father. We did our best to prevent him from carrying out this plan, but it was all in vain. For financial reasons, the distressed son was anxious to accelerate his father's passing, and now you see the result, hatred and infirmity. God created beings and celestial regions, but we insist on transforming ourselves into diabolical spirits, creating our own individual hell." Chapter 31, The Vampire. It was 9 o'clock in the evening, and we had not yet had a moment's rest except for the short consultations necessary for the solution of spiritual problems. Here I saw a patient begging for help, over there another in need of magnetic passes. On our way to assist two patients in Pavilion 11, I heard screams in a nearby ward. I would have run in that direction, if Narcissa had not held me back. "Please don't go," she warned, "the sexually unbalanced patients are lodged there. The picture would be too painful to your eyes. Wait until you are better prepared." I did not insist, but thousands of questions rushed to my mind. A new world was unfolding itself and my curiosity was great. I had to concentrate on Liza's mother's advice so as not to become distracted from my legitimate duties. Soon after 9, a quaint little man, to all appearances a humble worker, emerged from amidst the trees of the enormous park. I later learned that he belonged to the Sentinel Corps of the Chambers of Rectification. Narcisa greeted him and asked, "What is the matter, Justin? What is your message?" "I've come to inform you that an unfortunate woman is begging for help at the large gate that leads to the tilling fields. I believe she must have escaped the attention of the frontline sentinels," he answered, anxiously. "And why don't you help her?" asked the nurse. The guard gestured and hastened to explain, "According to our regulations, we are forbidden to. The poor creature is surrounded by black spots." "Really?" she exclaimed, taken aback. "Yes, nurse. It's just as I tell you. Then it's a very serious cause." I was filled with curiosity, and followed her for a considerable distance across the moonlit fields. We were surrounded by the silent park, its shady trees rustling gently in the soft breeze. After walking for well over a mile, we came to the gate. There stood the pitiful figure of a woman begging for mercy from the other side. I saw nothing but a squalid creature dressed in rags with a hideous face, and legs covered with raw sores, but, judging from her startled expression, I realized that Narcisa saw many more details, still imperceptible to me. "Children of God," she cried on seeing us, "please give shelter to my weary soul. Where is the paradise of the elect, that I may enjoy the peace I long for?" I was filled with compassion at her tearful voice. Narcisa, though also sorry for the unfortunate beggar, whispered to me, "Can't you see the black spots?" "No, I can't. Your spirit vision isn't sufficiently trained. If it depended on me, I would let her in at once, but on dealing with creatures in this condition, I can't decide for myself. I must apply to the chief warden on duty." She approached the poor woman, and said kindly, "Please, just wait a few minutes." We hurried back to the house, where for the first time I came into contact with the chief of sentinels of the Chambers of Rectification. Narcisa introduced us and then rapidly reported the occurrence. "You were right to have come to me," he replied. "Let's go see her." We were soon back at the gate. The chief warden carefully examined the newcomer from the lower zone and declared, "For the time being, this woman can't receive our assistance. She is one of the strongest vampires." By vampire, the spirit author refers to one who extinguishes life for personal advantage. Translator's note: I have ever come across. She must be left to herself. I could not help but shocked at those words. Wouldn't it be neglecting our Christian duty to abandon this unhappy sister to her fate? Narcisa seemed to think likewise, and tried to plead with the chief warden, "But, Brother Paul, wouldn't it be possible to shelter this poor creature in the chambers?" Pointing to the beggar who was impatient at the delay and complaining loudly, he addressed the nurse. "To allow her to enter would be to neglect my responsibility as a warden. Narcisa, have you noticed anything else besides the black spots?" Narcisa had not, and he continued, "Well, I have. Count the black spots." Narcisa looked intently at the woman, and, after a few moments, replied that there were 58. Brother Paul continued, patiently, "Those 58 dark spots represent so many children killed at birth. On each of these spots I can perceive the mental image of one of the little children whose life she extinguished, some by crushing blows, others by suffocation. This unhappy creature was a gynecologist who exploited inexperienced young women, committing heinous crimes under the pretext of easing the conscience of others. She is in a worse position than cases of suicide or murders who may, at times, show mitigating circumstances. I recalled the numerous cases in my practice when, to save the mother's life, the unborn child had to be sacrificed. But, reading my thoughts," Brother Paul added, "of course, I'm not referring to legitimate measures which are forms of redeeming trials, but to the crime of killing those who had obtained the sublime right to live and are about to begin their sojourn on the physical plane. yielding to the feelings of compassion inherent in noble souls. Narcissa again attempted to intercede on her behalf. "Brother Paul, I was also a great sinner in the past. Please, let's take in this unhappy woman. I promise to make her my special concern." "My friend," he answered, "I know we are all greatly indebted spirits. However, we have improved enough to acknowledge our own weaknesses and work to redeem our errors. All this woman wants, for the time being, is to create disturbance and confusion among our workers of goodwill. Those who haven't yet freed themselves from the bonds of hypocrisy emit destructive forces. Now, what would be the use of our vigilance if it were not to keep out dangerous influences? Let's prove what I have said," he added, with a meaningful smile. He then approached the beggar and asked her, "Sister, what do you ask of our brotherly cooperation?"
"Help, help," she replied, dolefully.
"But, my friend," he reasoned, "we must learn to accept expiatory suffering. Why did you so often cut the life thread of helpless little infants, who, with God's permission, were about to begin a redeeming struggle on earth?" At these words she looked around apprehensively, assumed a hateful expression and shouted, "Who is accusing me of this infamy? My conscience is at peace. I spent my whole life on earth working on behalf of motherhood. I was charitable and pious, good and pure. I am sorry, but the record of your thoughts and actions tell a different story. I believe, sister, that you haven't yet received the benefit of remorse. When you open your soul to the blessings of God, acknowledging your own needs, then you may come to us. Devil, wizard," she yelled furiously at him, "Satan's own follower. I'll never come here again. I am waiting for the promised heaven, which I hope to find. Then please go your own way. Your heaven isn't here. This is a place of work, where patients are aware of their infirmity and are assisted by brothers and sisters of goodwill to struggle back to health. I haven't asked for any remedy of assistance," she retorted angrily. "All I want is the paradise my good works entitle me to enter." Shooting us a parting look of hatred, she discarded the assumed appearance of a wandering beggar and walked away defiantly, with firm steps and a haughty gait. Brother Paul gazed at the retreating figure for quite a while, then turned to us and added, "Did you observe the vampire? She has grime written all over her and pleads innocence. She is obviously wicked and yet declares herself good and pure. She suffers desperately and feigns tranquility. She has created a hell for herself, yet pretends to be looking for heaven." We listened respectfully to the chief warden, who closed his valuable lesson by saying, "We must always be aware of appearances, either good or bad. Divine providence never forsakes anybody. Therefore, that unfortunate creature will find aid elsewhere. But for the sake of legitimate charity, in the position I hold here, I couldn't possibly open our doors to her." Chapter 32, Learning About Veneranda. Returning across the moonlit park, I experienced a strange sense of fascination. Those big, shady trees and flourishing patches of greenery held my admiring attention. As we walked, I questioned her about the surroundings. "This great park," she said, "not only contains the path to the lower zone and the plants we cultivate for nutritious juices, but Minister Veneranda has also created delightful areas used for educational purposes." Noting my curiosity, she continued, "They are known as the Green Halls, and are situated in the midst of the trees. They are perfectly suited for the lectures given by the ministers of regeneration. The most beautiful is reserved for the governor's lectures when he visits us. Others are used for visiting ministers and students in general. The elegant trees blossom periodically, looking like small, colorful towers of natural charm. The sky is our sheltering roof, allowing us to enjoy the blessings of the sun and of distant stars. How marvelous these natural places must be," I exclaimed. "They certainly are," she continued. 40 years ago, Minister Veneranda's idea aroused great enthusiasm all over the colony, and a campaign was begun to build a natural hall. Every ministry, including the Ministry of Divine Union, worked, with Veneranda's cooperation, to build delightful arbors all over the water park. I think the ones they built in the schools are the most interesting. They vary greatly in size and shape.
One of them, which Veneranda built in the educational park of the Ministry of Elucidation, is star-shaped, contains prodigious vegetation, and is ample enough for 5 large classes taught by 5 different instructors. In its center is an enormous apparatus, similar to a projector, which can simultaneously show 5 different projections. Their initiative improved the city, providing areas which unite useful service, practicality, and spiritual beauty. How are the halls furnished? I inquired as she paused. In the same style as earthly ones? Narcissa smiled and continued, No, it's different. Thinking of gospel scenes of Jesus' passage on earth, Veneranda suggested that all building materials be taken directly from nature. Each hall has benches and chairs carved out of the ground and covered with soft, sweet-smelling grass, lending it a restful and distinctive beauty. Declaring that it would be fitting to recall the Master's sermons on the open beach during his travels along the Sea of Tiberias, she introduced the idea of natural furnishings. The halls require constant care, but they return so much in the way of beauty and lovely scenery. The kind nurse fell silent for a moment, and then continued again, As I have already told you, most beautiful hall in our ministry is reserved for the governor's talks. Veneranda learned that he had always ancient Hellenic landscapes, and decorated it accordingly, shady bowers and seats composed of the interlaced branches of trees. Every 30 days the flowers change in species, and each month presents a new color scheme. The loveliest one is reserved for December, in honor of Jesus' birth when our colony receives beautiful thoughts and earnest promises from our incarnate brothers, and we, in turn, send our hopes and service to the higher spheres in homage to the Master of Masters. Perhaps you already know that the Governor visits us nearly every week, on Sundays. He stays for hours, conferring with the ministers of regeneration and talking to workers, offering valuable suggestions, examining our borderlines with the lower zone, receiving our visits and good wishes, and comforting convalescents. Sometimes, when he has time in the evenings, he stays to listen to music and to attend shows staged by the youth of our schools. Most visitors in the Astral City come to our ministry just to see that natural place which comfortably seats over 30,000 people. Listening to Narcissa, I experienced a pleasant sensation, half joy, half curiosity. Minister Veneranda's hall, she added, enthusiastically, is also magnificent. We give its upkeep special care and attention. All we can do in recognition of her great devotion is nothing compared to the outstanding service she has given us. This servant of the Lord has introduced numerous beneficial measures on behalf of the city's most unfortunate inhabitants. Her service record at the Astral City is considered by the government as one of the most praiseworthy. She has the greatest number of working hours in our colony, and is the oldest officer in the government and in the ministry. She has been in active service here for over 200 years. How venerable she must be! I exclaimed. You are right, she answered. She is one of the most highly evolved beings in our spirit colony. The 11 ministers who share the direction of the Ministry of Regeneration with her always seek her advice before making any important decision. Even the governor himself often consults her for her enlightened opinion. Only she and the governor have seen the Master Jesus in the resplendent spheres. Yet she never mentions that distinction of her spirit life, she avoids all reference to it. I can tell you of another significant incident. One day, 4 years ago, the Astral City prepared to entertain the Fraternities of Light who rule the Christian destinies of America. They were coming to pay their respects to Veneranda and to bestow the Service Merit Medal on her for having completed 1,000,000 consecutive hours of useful service with admirable devotion, perseverance and self-effacement. She is the first in the colony to be awarded with such an honor. When presented with a medal, she only wept in silence. Afterwards, she donated it to the town archives, and transferred the honor to the colony as a collective group, saying that she was unworthy of it. Despite the governor's protests, she requested that all the celebrations be cancelled. She never again alluded to this incident. What an extraordinary woman! I said. I wonder why she doesn't inhabit some higher sphere. Spiritually, she lives in planes far superior to ours, and only remains in the astral city out of a great spirit of love and abnegation. I have heard that our sublime benefactress has been working for 1,000 years to help a group of loved ones still on Earth. Meanwhile, she waits for them with untiring patience. How might I come to know her? I asked earnestly. Pleased at my interest, she answered, "Tomorrow evening, after the prayers, Minister Venerand is coming to her hall to give some apprentices a lecture on thought." Chapter 33, Curious Observations. Just before midnight, with Narcisse's permission, I went to the gates of the chambers. The Samaritans were expected at any moment. It was necessary, therefore, to watch out for their arrival, so that the last-minute measures necessary might be taken in time. With emotion, I walked down the pathway, here and there, among the shady trees. I saw tree trunks suggesting the earth's hoary oak, and other leaves that bring to mind the acacia tree and the pine. In the open air I experienced a sensation of well-being such as I had never felt in the chambers, in spite of their ample windows. While advancing silently under the sheltering branches gently stirring in the breeze, I felt a profound peace fall upon me. I began to reminisce about events in my life after my first meeting with Minister Clarence. I wondered where the dream region was situated. Was it on Earth, or in this spirit colony? I wondered what had happened to Zelia and the children. Although I had received so many explanations about the most varied aspects of life, my earthly home was never mentioned. My own mother had advised silence and had only addressed this matter vaguely. It all implied that I should forget the problems of the flesh in order to achieve my inner renewal. Yet, probing deeply, I discovered that my longing for my family was still alive and strong. I yearned to see my beloved wife, to feel my children's caresses once again. Why should fate keep us apart, as if I were a castaway on some unknown shore? These questions perplexed me, but I was also comforted by the thought that I could not consider myself forsaken. If my earthly experiences might be classified as a wreck, it was all my own doing. Now that I had the opportunity to observe the vibrations of intense and constructive work at the Astral City, I could not help wondering how I, when on Earth, could have wasted so much time on trifles. True, I had loved my wife dearly, and had tenderly cherished our children. Yet on examining my conduct as a husband and father, I realized that I had failed to build up anything solid and useful within the spirit of my family. I realized it only now, that it was too late. Whoever advances along a road and neglects to sow the seed for a future harvest along the way, and fails to protect the fountain that quenches his thirst, cannot turn back expecting to find all he needs. These thoughts kept recurring in my mind with an irritating insistence. On leaving the physical sphere, I had been faced with the torture of incomprehension. I did not know what had happened to my wife and children, who were suddenly deprived of the accustomed domestic stability and confronted with the inevitable struggles of widowhood and orphanhood, but I saw no point in asking. A light breeze seemed to whisper lofty ideas, as if attempting to lift my mind to higher thoughts. Although tormented with these inner questions, I had to attend to the mission on which I had been sent. I approached the gate and scrutinized the distance beyond the tilling fields. All was moonlight and serenity, glorious heavens and peaceful beauty. I spent some minutes absorbed in odd prayer to the Creator of all things and contemplation of the lovely scenery before me. A few moments later I saw two enormous shapes. They puzzled me. They looked like men of some indefinable semi-luminous substance. Strange filaments hung from their arms and feet, and there was a thread connected to their heads. They gave me the impression of two ghosts, and I could not bear their sight. My hair standing on end, I ran back to the chambers. As I anxiously explained to Narcisse the cause of my terrors, she could hardly keep from laughing. "Well, now," she said, good-humoredly, "didn't you recognize those forms?" I was considerably abashed and did not know what to say. Narcisse smiled and explained, "I had the same experience, and what was just as surprised as you. The explanation is simple, though. The forms you saw belong to our brothers from Earth. They are highly evolved spirits on some redeeming mission on the physical plane, who, as worthy initiates of eternal wisdom, may temporarily abandon their fleshly bodies and travel freely through our spheres. The filaments and threads you observed are the characteristics which distinguish them from us. Therefore, you needn't fear. Incarnate men who succeed in reaching these regions are highly evolved spirits, though they may appear humble or obscure on Earth. In an encouraging voice she added, "Let's go out and see. It's 12:40. The Samaritans can't be long in coming." Satisfied with Narcissa's explanation, I followed her to the great gate. I could still see the two forms in the distance, calmly walking away from the astral city. Narcissa gazed at them, and remarked, "They are surrounded by blue light. They must be two advanced messengers from the physical plane on some mission we cannot know." We stood at the gate for some time, lost in the contemplation of the silent fields. Finally, my kind friend pointed out a dark spot traveling across the moonlit horizon. They had arrived. Looking intently in the direction Narcissa was pointing, I saw that the caravan was moving slowly towards us under the clear sky. All of a sudden I heard dogs barking in the far distance. "What's that?" I asked, startled. "Why, dogs," said the nurse. "They are precious helpers in the obscure regions of the lower zone, which is inhabited not only by discarnate men, but also by real monsters. This, however, is not the proper time to describe them." Then, raising her voice, she called to the other servants in the distance, and sent one of them back to the chambers with the news of the Samaritans' arrival. I gazed curiously at the strange group approaching slowly. I counted 6 big carts or stage coaches, each drawn by animals which, even from a distance, looked like mules and preceded by a lively pack of dogs. What caught my attention most were the bands of large birds flying close to the carts and making strange sounds. At this sight I turned to Narcissa and inquired, "Where is the Airbus? Couldn't they use it in the lower zones?" As Narcissa shook her head, I asked for an explanation. As usual, she was willing to oblige, and answered, "It's a problem of the density of matter. Water and air are a good example. An airplane which flies through the air cannot do the same in water. We can build machines such as submarines, for instance, which can carry us through denser matter, but in deference to the suffering inhabitants of the region, communities of higher planes prefer to use this simple means of transportation. Besides, we often can't do without animal collaboration." "Why is that?" I asked with astonishment. "Dogs simplify the work, and mules carry weight patiently and supply warmth when necessary. Those birds," she added, pointing to them in the air, "which we call traveling ibises, are the Samaritans' great allies. They eat hateful and wicked thought forms, helping to fight against the dark shapes of the lower zone." The caravan was growing nearer. Narcissa, gazing at me kindly, continued, "There is no time now for further details. You can find valuable lessons on animals not here, but in the Ministry of Elucidation, where the parks of instruction and experiments are located." Busily supervising the last-minute arrangements, the devoted nurse prepared to receive the new patients. Chapter 34, Newcomers from the Lower Zone. The packs of dogs, led by strong workers, halted as they approached us. Within minutes, we were all crossing the broad galleries leading into the chambers of rectification. Many attendants were hurrying about. Some of the weaker patients were being helped indoors. Not only Narcissa, Celestius and the others were working, the Samaritans were also doing their utmost, eager to aid the newcomers, some of whom waiting humbly for their turn while others complained loudly. As I also lent a hand, I noticed an old lady, trying with great difficulty to get down from the last carriage. When she saw me nearby she began to beg, "Please, son, for God's sake, help me to get down." I approached, interested. "Good heavens," she went on, forming the sign of the cross, "thanks to divine providence I have escaped purgatory. Oh, the wicked devils which tormented me there. What a hellish place. At last, heavenly angels have come to my rescue." I helped her down, again curious. For the first time I heard references to hell and purgatory from someone who seemed calm and reasonable to me. Prompted by my curiosity, I inquired, "So, have you come far?" Thus speaking, oblivious of Laura's advice, I affected great concern, as I had on earth. The poor woman perceived my interest and began telling her story. Very far indeed. On earth, my son, I was a lady of great virtues, charitable and pious, sincere in my beliefs,